Annuncio vobis gaudium magnum.
Habemus Podcast. Welcome to Omnia Est Politicus from NPR News. I'm Ron Elving.
And I'm Ken Rudin.
And Ken, it's been quite a moving week. I know you've been at the Vatican. You've been there in Rome all week long covering
this. The Vatican's in Rome?
Covering this with Silvia Poggioli and some of the other NPR correspondents.
No, I was very excited because when I heard Pope Francis, which I understand is the first Pope Francis in Sinatra, but I think what's exciting about this is that given his views on abortion and women.
Gay marriage.
I just heard he was invited to speak at CPAC, and that's exciting.
Well, actually, I'm sure CPAC would love to have him because he would give them a little star power. And apart from that, right now the headliner appears to be Donald Trump. But let's also bear in mind that at least as Archbishop and Cardinal, the man who is now Pope Francis was very conservative on theological issues, very orthodox on the church's issues, but at the same time was considered something of a political liberal because he was always talking about the poor. He himself lived very simply.
He was very humble.
Would not take on any of the trappings of his office.
The fact is that if we're talking about the Catholic religion, the place in the world where the Catholic religion is surviving and thriving is Latin America.
Well, not the only place, but it is certainly the primary place. The 40% of all the Catholics in the world are in South America. A very large proportion, a very large majority overall are in the Southern Hemisphere. So it was a lovely sort of transitional move to take a guy who is the son of Italian immigrants and has an Italian name, although obviously they pronounce it with the Spanish pronunciation in Argentina. An Italian popularity contest would have been won probably by the cardinal from Milan. But in this particular case, he could come out on the loggia. Notice how much I've learned this week.
It's impressive.
He could come out there and he could speak in Italian to this massive crowd. More than 100,000 people gathered there in St. Peter's Square.
The one thing I learned is that the cardinal from Chicago voted twice. And I thought that was appropriate.
I thought it was appropriate,
it was.
On the other hand. It was a lovely gesture. We appreciated it in Chicago. So as we were saying a moment ago, since they could not get Pope Francis, the CPAC folks are beginning, even as we speak, with some basically standard issue big names from last year. People like Donald Trump, people like Mitt Romney, people like Paul Ryan, people we heard about a lot in 2012 and may hear more about in some cases in 2016, although I doubt Trump or Romney will run.
Or Sarah Palin, who has a big role in a CPAC as well this year. Here's the thing, though. The headlines of the week were, or the last several weeks, was that Chris Christie was not invited. Bob McDonnell, the popular outgoing governor of Virginia, not invited.
Practically. Well, he's right across the river. I mean, this thing is being held right
well,
by the Potomac
River. But the fact is, he just broke with orthodoxy, speaking of orthodoxy, and on things like taxes, things like that. But Mitt Romney was always questioned by conservatives. Shelley Moore Capito, the likely Republican Senate nominee in West Virginia, thought of suspiciously by true blue conservatives. She's speaking there. The question is, I'm wondering is, look, I think it's great. I think it's the first meeting of conservative leaders around the country and personalities since the election. But this is not the Republican National Convention.
No,
this is not the Republican. We're not saying, well, I can't believe the party is excluding Chris Christie. The party isn't excluding Chris Christie. The party isn't excluding Bob McDonnell. CPAC is.
That's right. And CPAC, Conservative Political Action Conference, has been around for about four decades.
Since the Reagan administration.
Since before the Reagan.
Right.
And he was one of their great heroes in the years before he was actually president. And he was posing himself against Gerald Ford, the president, in 1975 and 76. And he, you know, was a big part of making CPAC popular. And CPAC was playing something of a role in helping Ronald Reagan become more acceptable to more Republicans. There's a real difference between the party and CPAC. But as you said, this is the first real gathering of people who overwhelmingly identify as Republican as opposed to Democratic. And this is the first real gathering of conservatives with this kind of firepower and this many people who are potential 2016 candidates since November.
Of course, there will be the obligatory 2016 straw poll at CPAC. We do know that Ron Paul, when he was still in Congress, of course, was one of the people who often had won the CPAC straw poll. Mitt Romney won it a bunch of times, including in 2008 after he dropped out of the race. I think in 2005, Rudy Giuliani, the epitome of social conservatism,
scarcely.
Not won the straw poll. So we do make a big deal of this. We do make a big deal of the exclusions. We do make a big deal of the straw poll. But at the same time, you're absolutely right. Bobby Jindal, Paul Ryan, Marco Rubio, even Jeb Bush, these could be the names of 2016.
Ted Cruz, right? And, you know, we haven't talked about Ted Cruz terribly much because, on this podcast, because at least as a presidential candidate, his birth in Canada would seem to disqualify him.
Right.
However, we are informed that Senator Cruz considers himself to be an American citizen, native born, by the definition of the Constitution, because his mother was an American citizen and she was native born. Now, whether or not that's going to pass constitutional muster down the road.
Which has never been tested. Remember, Lowell Weicker was born in Paris. He ran for president. George Romney was born in Mexico.
John McCain was born in Panama.
Panama Canal Zone.
Well, he was born in the Canal Zone, which is a little bit of a separate question, on a U.S. military base. So that raises the question of whether or not that's U.S.
And Barry Goldwater was born in Arizona before it was a state. We could do all these kind of...
That's right. And Barack Obama was born in at least five or six different countries, according to what I see on the internet.
And according to John Brennan, with this new drone program, if Canada is annexed as one of the states, then Ted Cruz can run for president. And so that's a possibility
as well.
There
you go. Absolutely. That John Brennan is a clever fellow.
He is.
And there are a lot of other things going on at CPAC besides presidential politics. There are a lot of people looking back at the 2012 election and looking forward to future elections and saying, how should the conservatives try to bring their message to a new generation in terms of youth and a new generation or a new category of Americans in terms of emerging voters, Hispanics, Asians, people who in the 2012 election voted overwhelmingly Democratic.
Well, we did see some of that dynamic this week. This is not front page news, but the fact is that George P. Bush, the older son of Jeb Bush, former governor of Florida, announced this week that he's going to run for Texas Land Commissioner. Now, that doesn't seem like a very important position, but it is very important. It deals with mineral resources and land issues. And again, David Dewhurst, as you well know, the current lieutenant governor of Texas, was the Texas Land Commissioner. So, look, if there's any lesson that the Republicans learned from 2012, and we're still questioning what lessons they did learn, but one of them may be about how to woo, how to win Latino voters. And not that you have to have a Latino face, a Latino name to do so, because that's kind of simplistic, but George P. Bush, a candidate for statewide office and perhaps higher office in the future, took one of those steps this week by declaring for Texas Land Commissioner.
All right, and somebody to keep an eye on in the future. And we're also, of course, going to see a lot of those Hispanic speakers at CPAC. And there are also various and sundry other kinds of workshops going on. The use of film, how to get the kind of message out in film and in perhaps even commercial movies made in Hollywood that conservatives would prefer to see other than the messaging they see in the commercial films in theaters today.
You talked about old generation versus the new generation. A perfect example of that was seen on the Senate floor in the last week or so when, of course, Rand Paul had his 13-hour filibuster, not so much against the president's drone program.
What about bringing it to the U.S.?
Bringing it to the U.S.
and using it against American citizens in their cafes. Absolutely.
Exactly. But it was interesting that one of the old names of the Republican Party, John McCain, thought this was beneath the Republican Party.
The country needs more senators who care about liberty. But if Mr. Paul wants to be taken seriously, he needs to do more than pull political stunts that fire up impressionable libertarian kids in their college dorms. He needs to know what he's talking about.
Okay, there's our outreach to the youth.
Now, you know something? I mean, McCain does like, you know, he's a maverick after all.
After all.
He and James Garner.
He goes rogue.
He does go rogue. But this seems to be telling a growing portion of the Republican Party that you're completely irrelevant.
Well, I think the choice of the phrase wacko birds by Senator McCain could be taken as a negative designation.
not if you speak to some of the Ron Paul's.
Well, I understand. But Rand Paul and Ted Cruz and some other people who have recently rubbed the senator the wrong way have all been lumped together in this sort of Tea Party designation, even though, gee, it was just a little while ago, 2010, that John McCain was out there trying very hard to woo these same Tea Party folks to vote for him in the Republican primary in the Arizona Senate race that year.
And it's interesting that if you think of the people who came on board with Rand Paul, it was not only Mitch McConnell, it was not only Reince Priebus, the head of the Republican Party, it was other stalwart conservatives like
John Thune,
Bill Maher. No, but
oh, you mean on the drone issue? But now the drone issue is an interesting kind of
it's definitely
of category
not,
buster.
Not D versus R. It's That's not right. D versus R.
That's right. Ron Wyden came out on the floor during the Rand Paul filibuster, and while he wasn't exactly supporting the filibuster, he was trying to kind of pull the issue in a direction that's more interesting to Ron Wyden. He has raised questions about this for a long time, and it is, of course, a fundamental question of whether or not the president has the right to order a drone strike against somebody suspected of terrorism here at home, an American citizen domestically. And finally, of course, Attorney General Eric Holder, in response to all this filibuster and so on, wrote this two-line letter, you know, saying, it has come to my attention that you have questions about this and whether or not the president can order such a drone strike. The answer to that question is no.
Except for Kentucky. Right. Exactly.
As well, Rand Paul said he accepted that, and that was sort of the quote-unquote end of that, except that it was just the beginning of the elevation of Rand Paul in the media.
But for John McCain to talk about the irrelevance of Rand Paul focusing on drones in the United States, I'm sorry, but when John McCain focused on Benghazi in the confirmation hearings with Chuck Hagel, what did that have to do with Chuck Hagel? So it's interesting what is relevant to some people and what is completely irrelevant to the same people.
It's true, and we have talked a lot about the personal nature of the Hagel fight. We've talked a little bit about the personal nature of the filibuster fight last week and Mitch McConnell getting beaten up in some parts of the right-wing blogosphere for not having come to Rand Paul's assistance and given him aid earlier in the day. There's a lot of back and forth and a lot of tension within the Republican ranks over some of these issues, and also, I think, over what would have to be called personalities. John McCain doesn't like some of these new guys. Mitch McConnell doesn't like having other people decide what's going to happen on the floor for 12 or 13 hours when he's supposed to be the Republican leader. And there's some jockeying for position that's really quite independent of ideology. It just has to do with essentially what went on in the schoolyard.
Speaking of schoolyard, we still don't know what's going to go on the floor of the U.S. Senate or the floor of the Congress when, of course, competing budget plans were announced this week. Well, I know.
All right, we just lost the listener.
First, we should listen to Paul Ryan, the House Budget Committee chairman, who this week announced his budget proposal.
This is not only a responsible, reasonable, balanced plan. It's also an invitation. This is an invitation to the President of the United States, to the Senate Democrats, to come together to fix these problems.
That makes sense to me.
Yeah, I'm trying to think if there's a single person on the planet who believes that, including Paul Ryan. Paul Ryan knows perfectly well that the audience for this budget document that he brought out, which is essentially a retread of the last one he brought out, with the addition of a lot of new tax revenue that's been put in place since then and which he accepts.
Which basically was rejected at the polls in the 2012 election.
Rejected by everyone, including a lot of the people in his own party who don't want to go after Medicare and Medicaid the way Paul Ryan does and who don't want to be seen as lowering tax rates on the wealthy in order to go after Medicare and Medicaid the way Paul Ryan does. He is characterizing this as the entire party's position when it is not, and he is characterizing it as an invitation to compromise. It's extremely difficult to see how you're inviting somebody to compromise when one of the features of your plan is the complete repeal of Obamacare.
Exactly. I mean, you said you couldn't think of a single person who believes this stuff. I can't even think of a married person who believes it. It doesn't even have to be their marital status that matters. Ron, stay with me on this. Okay?
I think I'm staying with you on this. All right, and we talk about Paul Ryan's budget being unrealistic as a grounds for compromise. Look at what came out of the Senate. The Senate Budget Committee head is Patty Murray, Democratic Senator from Washington.
Our budget tackles this issue the way the American people have consistently said they want it done, with an equal mix of responsible spending cuts across the federal budget and new revenue raised by closing loopholes and cutting wasteful breaks that primarily benefit the rich.
The operative word here being the rich. So the Democrats, are they finding any middle ground here, or are we hearing their election rhetoric from 2012 again?
Well, of course it is. In my view, it's the same exact thing that Paul Ryan is offering. Of course, Patty Murray and the Democrats are talking about $1 trillion in higher taxes, or they call it enhanced revenue, and the Republicans will say, wait a second, we just raised taxes on the rich by $620 billion in January in the fiscal cliff deal.
Yeah.
So wait a second, we have yet to hear from the president, we have yet to hear the Democrats, where's going to be the corresponding spending cuts on entitlement programs, things like that?
Well, the Democrats don't want to cut entitlement programs. They don't want to
And the Republicans don't want to raise taxes.
So, you know, they really don't want to give on either side, and they've dug in their heels. Is there any hope that the president's so-called charm offensive, going to the Hill, talking to the caucuses of both parties in both the House and the Senate, will produce any kind of more flexible attitude? I put it to you, Ken Rudin.
Sure, there's a chance. I mean, there's a chance that people will tune into this podcast, but it's slim. Both are slim.
Well, okay. And as you say, I mean, I suppose the president will at least get marks for trying. But the degree to which he's going to change the atmosphere on Capitol Hill by going up there and talking to these groups, probably pretty limited. I think we can hear that in the reaction of Speaker John Boehner to the president's visit.
And I thought that we had a very frank and candid exchange of ideas. And frankly, I think it was productive. We know, however, that there are some very real differences.
He is John Boehner, the Speaker of the House.
He's a killer.
He's so funny.
He's a
laugh riot.
He is truly. And I thought we had a very frank and candid exchange of ideas.
You know that whenever two parties on opposite ends of the spectrum say that they have a candid and frank idea conversation, you know they're not any close to anything.
No, it was pretty much a waste of time. Also, watch for sentences that include two references to the word frank. We had a very frank exchange, and frankly, I thought it was frank.
And you know, you wonder, with all this comedy on Capitol Hill, you wonder why Carl Levin wants to leave after all this time.
I can't imagine why. Carl Levin, senior senator from Michigan,
the longest serving senator in Michigan history. He's like 8 feet tall.
And chairman of the Senate Armed Services Committee, which in some respects has been the pinnacle of his career. And there he is. He's running this committee. Granted, it's getting a little unpleasant, a little contentious there. But he's not going to run for re-election in 2014. Do you blame him?
Look, he's 78 years old. In 6 years, he would be, if he's 78 years old, and if he served another term...
he'd be well into his mid-80s.
Hold on. He'd be 84. So I think he decided that it was time to retire. Now, the question is...
Can we have somebody check the math?
I was told there would be no math. But anyway, so the Republicans are saying, oh, we have a great opportunity to pick up this seat. One of the Republicans who considered running for all of like 10 hours was Scott Romney. He's Mitt Romney's older brother, 71 years old, a lifelong Michigander, active in Michigan politics. He said he would love to run for the seat. Then he said, nah, I'm not going to do it. But what about my daughter, Ronna Romney McDaniel?
That's why he said he was considering it, because he knew that would get attention.
Oh, perhaps, yeah.
And then he could transfer that attention to his daughter, Ronna, who might actually be, for all we know, a very serious Republican candidate for office.
It looks like the Democrat who's going to replace him, at least as a nominee, is Congressman Gary Peters, has a lot of money in the bank. He ran statewide before. He was talking about running for governor. My guess is that the Democrats hold that seat with Gary Peters. Some other Democrats being mentioned. Jennifer Granholm's name has been mentioned, the former governor who lives in California. Debbie Dingell, the lobbyist and wife of John Dingell, has been mentioned. Makes no sense. What about Sandy Levin?
Sandy Levin?
He's 81 years
old. He's the older brother of Carl Levin.
Yeah, so I don't think any of those are running. Gary Peters will probably be the nominee.
Lots of interest in the city of Detroit while we're in Michigan this week in the naming of their new financial manager. I understand a crowd of 100,000 was gathered in the square out in front of the city hall when a little puff of white smoke came out announcing that they had a new financius managerius.
Well, given the reputation of Detroit, there's always a puff of white smoke there going there. But Kwame Kilpatrick, the former mayor, is going to prison for
corruption.
But when you're talking about Detroit, I'd rather focus less on Kwame Kilpatrick and more on the sadness of what's been the situation in Detroit for many, many years. Dave Bing, the former NBA great and current mayor, looks like he'll be supplanted by this overseer, this financial overseer.
Well, they've essentially lost control of their finances.
Right, and it looks, and I would suspect that Dave Bing is not going to run for re-election this year because it just seems to be totally unmanageable, and that's kind of sad.
All right, coming up next week, in South Carolina, we have that all-important Republican primary for the House seat that was vacated by Tim Scott when he was appointed to the United States Senate. So, is this the comeback moment for Mark Sanford, or is there a chance that one of the other, and there are many other Republican candidates, one of them might force a runoff to the primary and cut short the Mark Sanford comeback?
Well, there's no question that Mark Sanford, who I think goes into Tuesday's primary as the favorite, there's no question that he will not get a majority, which therefore goes to an April 2nd runoff. The question is, who gets into the runoff with Mark Sanford? Teddy Turner, son of Ted Turner, who basically is spending the whole campaign denouncing his liberal father, which is always very good.
Entertaining.
Smart politics.
Edible.
Larry Grooms, we talked about him in the podcast
last week.
State Senator, very conservative, but without the Mark Sanford baggage. The thing is, Mark Sanford does win the initial Tuesday primary. The question is, what happens in the runoff? Who faces them in the runoff? And when we're talking about the politics of redemption, this is a great example to see if Mark Sanford could get the forgiveness he's asking the voters of South Carolina's 1st District.
All right. And on the Democratic side, we expect the nominee to be Elizabeth Colbert Bush.
Right.
Who is, of course, the sister of the famous television personality.
George W. Bush.
And she will then, of course, be the... and then, of course, we will have the general election in May.
Yeah. Of course, she's not the sister of George W. Bush or even...
Anheuser Bush.
She was great. I loved Anne.
She was great. I loved
Anne. No, but she's the sister of Stephen Colbert. Elizabeth Colbert Bush will be the Democratic nominee.
Does she have a chance against any of the Republican candidates in this rock-ribbed Republican district?
I'm thinking no. The Democrats did come close in 1998 against Henry Brown, who was then the incumbent. The question is really not about the ideology or the Republicanism of the district. The question really is forgiveness about Mark Sanford.
A couple of notes about people who are or are not running for other offices this year. We have in Virginia a new governor to be elected later this year, and there the lieutenant governor has announced he will not run as a third-party candidate against the Republican and Democratic nominees. The Republican nominees assumed, of course, to be Attorney General Ken Cuccinelli.
Well, Bowling, of course, would have loved to have been governor. He wanted to be governor from the outset of this, the last four-year cycle. But Cuccinelli has the party machinery. He's much more conservative than Bowling. And they decide the nominee, the Republican nominee, through a state convention, which Bowling never would have won. There was some talk by Bowling that maybe he'll run as a third party, a conservative. But he announced this week that, one, he doesn't have enough money to win, certainly enough to win. And he really doesn't want to do a complete break from the Republican Party. But it was interesting. He said, I am not going to run. I wish Mr. Cuccinelli and Mr. McAuliffe, Terry McAuliffe,
yes,
the Democrat, mm-hmm, the best of luck. So it's going to be very interesting. He could still be a kingmaker, even though not as a candidate. One more note about Virginia. If Bill Bowling has a way of perhaps shaking up Republican politics in the state, former Governor Doug Wilder, a Democrat or a nominal Democrat, because he always seems to give his fellow Democrats more heartbreak and heartburn than anything else, he tweeted something kind of obnoxious about Terry McAuliffe that, you know, the voters will learn that he doesn't have any experience running government. Once again, that's Doug Wilder being Doug Wilder.
Apparently someone did not make the appropriate stop to secure the support of former Governor Wilder. But I did want to ask you also about one other candidacy. Ken, I know it pains you to talk about the state of New York, but I believe we have a leading candidate to be the next mayor of the city of New York?
Well, we do, at least as of now, and that's Christine Quinn, who, if elected, she would be the first openly gay mayor of New York City, but more, and also the first openly woman candidate. There's never been a female mayor of New York City.
Although we did see some pretty outrageous outfits on Mayor Giuliani in some, yeah, of those skits.
She announced her candidacy, and she not only went to all five boroughs, she went to three donkeys as well.
And that's it for this week's political podcast.
You can follow NPR's political coverage at npr.org/politics.
I'm Ron Elving.
And I'm Ken Rudin. The podcast is produced by Rachel Leshinsky and edited by Kathy Shaw.
Join us again next week for It's All Politics from NPR. Don't cry for me.